Thanks. Thank you. And yes, so as said, I'll be talking about the FluScape study, which is a study of immune landscapes in southern China, a study of influenza immunity in southern China. And specifically, I'll be talking about some of the insights we've had into the sort of landscapes of immunity to influenza in southern China, and sort of small-scale influenza dynamics and small-scale transmission. And as with all big projects like this, there's a host of other people who deserve at least as much credit as I do for everything I say, and none of the blame. So, and this study is one I think is really interesting and exciting because it's based on the idea of trying to actually go out and measure and test some of the hypotheses that come out of models of infectious disease transmission and come out of these models, pairing in a way more than simply like estimating parameters or checking parameters, actually pairing those estimates with biological outcomes. And, there's a lot of big models of influenza spread out there, like this one, like this whole series of stuff that came out of the early cases of H5N1 or the reemergence of H5N1 cases in humans and concerns about pandemics. They are these beautiful agent-based models. They made great, could somebody close the door perhaps? They made, great, beautiful animations, and, really, policymakers love them. But the underlying machinery of these models, though, was actually fairly simple. For this model, there's a travel kernel, and people, that sort of dictates how people travel, how far people go, and this was based on commuting data about how people go to work, not really looking at anything about how people, what contacts people have that are specifically likely to transmit the disease of interest, influenza, and even more so, this information was not in any way paired with any biological outcome that any measure of influenza transmission. So it takes a lot from our mechanistic understanding of how influenza transmits, but it doesn't have any pairing with the biological outcome. So this is really one of the big underlying motivations of the work, is to see if these frameworks really make sense for influenza transmission. And then another part of it is that there's, as I think most of you know, that influenza drifts anagenically. It changes over time. And on the left here, we have a very cool map that Derek Smith and some others developed. The important thing to know is that the space between the areas in those maps designates immunological cross-reactivity and presumably cross-protection. And that over time, the virus is changing and moving away. And there's sort of an ongoing debate about the ecological and evolutionary processes that lead to this. And one of the hypotheses that is part of that debate is that the area in Southeast Asia, including southern China, may be sort of a source where the virus circulates between these large interconnected populations with different seasonality continuously, and that's leading to and driving the drift in diversity. There's also plenty of people who say that's BS, but this is a debate. But if that is the case, then the immunological landscape of that area is especially particularly important in how influenza evolves over time and what we see in terms of new vaccine strains and stuff. So motivated by all of this, we picked the study site in southern China. Centered on Guangzhou, which is a large city of 9 million people, a lot of manufacturing, a lot of international trade. It's a two-hour train ride from Hong Kong. So we picked an area along that. And on this map, this is Guangzhou, and the shading indicates population density. And we wanted to look at different population densities and sort of a gradient of population density and a gradient of different human contacts with the rest of the world over time as you moved away from the city. So you can see this transect or pie splice coming out there, which is our study area, goes from this very dense area to these far less dense areas. And we picked 40 study sites, spatially random, over that area in order to look at these differences. And you can see that, this is a study site central to the area, very dense, a lot of people live there. There are these huge apartment blocks that have thousands and thousands of people in them, like right next to each other. And then this is sort of at the further edges of our study site. It's a farming community. There was a gentleman there who hadn't left the community in 10 years, despite it being fairly close to Guangzhou. So within each of these locations, we recruited 20 households. For each household, we tried to recruit every single member of the household. We administered a demographic survey on the household and the individual level. We administered a contact survey looking at the contacts from the previous day to us showing up there, and we collected a blood sample. And we've done this in three rounds, but the third round's ongoing. Today I'm going to just be talking about results from the first round in the pilot studies. So the contact survey looks something like this, except it's in Chinese. And it works like you go through and you say, and it's an interviewer-led survey, which we think is very important, and you go through and you say, okay, you got up in the morning, who's the first person you met? How old were they? What was their, why did you meet them? Where did you meet them? And, what were you doing? Did it involve touch? And then, okay, well, what was the next thing you did? Who did you meet there? And go through designating the people and the groups that you meet throughout the day like that. And importantly, we get named locations as part of that process. And our study staff goes out to the area and geocodes all those named locations. So we have GPS points for every contact that people reported. As you move further away from the study area, those GPS points necessarily get cruder, but we have these GPS points. And here you can see this is the points of all the contacts from the first round. This is 30-some thousand contacts. You can tell where the study sites are because there's a lot of contacts there, but their contacts occur throughout the region and they occur throughout China. So one of the big questions about, that you ask yourself when you start looking at people's contacts and you start mapping that to models of infectious disease is what are the heterogeneities, right? The simplest models assume everybody walks around like a random cloud and just hits each other, but we know that's not the case. And we know one really important heterogeneity is that people tend to interact with people of their own ages. And this is this age assortivity. So in this study, we found a lot of age assortivity. So this is what you're seeing here is a age group of the participant here, so the person reporting contact, and then the age group of the people that they contacted. In the first round, we were probably a little too crude on this. Yellow and the number indicates how much. If it's yellow, that indicates there's more contact with that group than we'd expect by random mixing. Blue indicates less, and the number indicates how much. And you see here in the number of contacts on the, for you guys left, you see what you have seen in a lot of European studies, which is pretty strong age assortivity. People tend to have contacts in number of contacts with people their own ages. We also see assortivity in the time spent in contacts, though that's less pronounced. Also, young children tend to have elevated amounts of contact with people of childbearing age, so they're contacting their parents. What we don't see as strongly as you see in a lot of the European studies or a lot of the other studies is that people of childbearing age having contacts with children. There's two possibilities here. One is that in this first round, we unfortunately made our age categories a little bit cruder than maybe we should have. So that could be partially responsible. But another possibility is that there is a, you know, still a one-child policy that's moderately enforced in China, and, you know, so people may not have as big of families. We also see heterogeneity. You know, also you remember from that early figure I showed you, we were really interested in the geographic spread of contact, how far people were going away from their homes and contacts, and we do see heterogeneities there. In particular, so these figures show the percentage of contacts a particular distance or further from home. And in particular, you know, so people living in urban areas are more are less likely to have a contact in the home, and the contacts that are close by within a certain distance range tend to be a bit closer to home than people in the rural areas. And you can see this here. Where orange is the urban and blue is the rural. But as you get further from home, people in the rural areas, if the contact is greater than a certain distance from home, their contacts tend to be further from home than the urban, you know, than the people living in the urban area. We also see a lot of heterogeneity in the distance of contact by age, with people, you know, young adults and working age adults having the contacts furthest from home, and older individuals tending to stay closer to home or having more contacts in home. So as I said, we really wanted to pair this with biological outcome. We're not just interested in how people interact. So everybody gave blood, and we performed serological assays on the blood. We performed, for a subset, we performed neutralization titers, which are a fairly specific measure of antibody response to influenza strains. They measure the ability of antibodies in the blood to neutralize the function of the virus. Far cheaper, but a little bit less specific, are hemagglutinin inhibition assays, which measure the ability of antibodies in the blood to stop the influenza from binding with cells. And like I said, because influenza is changing over time, antigenically, and evolving over time, it's important to note that the antigenic response to a strain also corresponds to a point in time. You know, so we have some mapping. It's a very noisy signal, but we do have some mapping between influenza between a point in time and an antibody response based on this immune response. So this is all the data from our pilot study. This is 150 individuals. This is neutralization titers. I guess it's not all data. It's all the influenza A data. H3N2 data. Across the rows, we have sorted by year of circulation, we have strains of influenza A, some major antigenic grouping, strains of influenza A going from the oldest to the most recent. And then in the columns, we have every individual in the pilot study sorted by age. And then the shading indicates what their immunological response or what their titer was to that particular strain. And first thing you can notice is nicely, people don't seem to have immunological reactions to strains that circulated when they weren't alive, which is good. It means we may be even measuring something. But also you notice very quickly that there seems to be, even among strains circulating when people are alive, that there seems to be an age pattern. It seems like these people who are younger tend to have higher titers than people who are older. So this is going to be for us to interpret the titer results and start interpreting differences by location, we really have to deal with this. So we develop, you can see this even clearer if you take a subset of strains and you put on the y-axis, you put in the titer, and then the x-axis, you put in age, and you fit a spline to that average. And if you look at it by people's age when you tested them, it looks like these curves maybe don't have anything to do with each other. It looks like a little bit of a mess. Every strain has its own curve. But if you then re-center things by people's age at the time of strain isolation, at the time when the strain was isolated, everything suddenly lines up in terms of when the peak is. And based on this, we fit a model of influenza response or antibody response to influenza, where people's age at the time the strain was isolated or the time the strain was circulating ends up being the strongest predictor of what people's titer to that strain will be. So here, negative 30 means that strain circulated 30 years before you were born. 0 means it circulated right when you were born. There's a little bit of cross-reactivity, so people do tend to have some titers to strains that were circulated after they were alive. But you tend to have the highest titer to strains that circulate when you're around 7, and then this smoothly declines thereafter. And this is by far, there is variation by strain. We have strain-specific intercepts. We have some stuff about absolute age, but it's this age at the time strains were circulating that is the biggest driver. And our hope is, and this is very preliminary work, so I'm not going to go that into it. Our hope is that combining that with this cross-reactivity, we can look at somebody's titer profile, and we can attribute how much we think each strain contributed to the individual titer that we're seeing. And then we can walk back from that and get some probabilistic estimate, and probably only informative at a population level, of what they were infected with. So let's get to bringing this all together. So one of the simplest models that you can make of spatial transmission of influenza or any disease is just to throw everything on line world. So you have a line. All your populations exist in a line, and you plunk down a giant urban population in the center. And you have smaller and smaller populations as you move away from that urban population that are slightly less connected to that urban population and are smaller, and have less people. And this is not completely different than sort of the way we think people interact in the world, but maybe becoming less and less true as time goes on. But if you do this and you run a bunch of stochastic simulations in it, what you find is that in the larger areas, in the large urban populations in the center, you'll have influenza epidemics every single year. As you move further and further away into the smaller populations, people will start missing years. And they'll have big epidemics in particular years, but you won't have epidemics every single year, and they'll be missed. So the question is, do we see a pattern like this in our actual study as we move away from Guangzhou? And if you ignore everything in the middle and squint your eyes, yes. We see some very large, responses to across strain. So the population densities in blue and these orange circles represent sort of a summary of antibody response across strains to influenza A in each location. And in the most central locations, that summary measure is very big. And at the most extremely far out locations, that summary measure is very small. There's a bunch of stuff going on in the middle that is not so easily explained. But we do see some trend, and there does seem to be some structure there. And we've looked at a number of things to try to explain the structure. And the thing that works best is population density, with the largest areas, sort of regardless of strain, except for the most recently circulating H3N2, tending to have the highest titers, and the smallest area, lowest density places, people having the smallest titer, the lowest titers. And also, if you look at just whether or not they have protective titers in these areas, you see similar trends. So there does seem to be, there may be an association with density. And in fact, if you take a more complex model, which is a gravity model, where you model the transmission of influenza using a gravity model, which is a particular model, a parametric model of human movement, you would expect a similar pattern where places with higher population density have higher attack rates. So we ran a very simple toy version of such a gravity model. And if you plot our location coefficients against the simulated attack rates for the model, you get what I say is one of the more frustrating types of graphs you can get in science. It looks like there's a trend there, and you're really excited, but then there are these very annoying points up here that seem to violate everything. So there's some work cut out for us to explain this, but it does seem like these types of simple predictions are not completely, completely out on left field from what we're finding in the more, when we actually go look in the empirical evidence. And that's not, the difference isn't completely surprising, because if we just look at our points and then throw down roads and stuff on it, you realize that there's a really complicated network going here. There's another big city down here. So anyway, this is, I'd like to thank all, a large number of collaborators with which this work hasn't been done, and particularly the NSF NIH EID program, which funds the work, and that's it.
Thanks, Justin. That was great. Again, we'll have time for a discussion and questions when all the speakers have spoken. So next we'll hear from Nick Reich. Nick is an assistant professor of biostatistics at UMass Amherst. His research are motivated largely by interests in global health problems and unites statistical and epidemiological practice. His active areas of research include developing time series and survival models for the spread of infectious diseases and optimizing design and analysis strategies for cluster randomized trials. At UMass, he teaches statistical modeling and data visualization using R, and is the author of several R packages. So, great to have Nick here. Let's see how to pull this up. I think you, what's that? Close to his first.